This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. Written by Brian Kaplan. Performed by Alan Robertson.
Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Introduction. Why anybody can have a brain, that's a very mediocre commodity. Every pusillanimous creature that crawls on the earth or slinks through slimy seas has a brain. Back where I come from, we have universities, seats of great learning, where men go to become great thinkers. And when they come out, they think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. But they have one thing you haven't got. A diploma. The Wizard of Oz. I have been in school continuously for over 40 years. First preschool, kindergarten, elementary, junior high, and high school. Then a 4-year bachelor's degree at UC Berkeley, followed by a 4-year PhD at Princeton. The next step was what you could call my first real job, as a professor of economics at George Mason University. 20 years later, I'm still here. In the fall, I'll be starting 41st grade. The system has been good to me, very good. I have a dream job for life. I'm expected to teach 5 hours of class, 30 weeks per year. Unlike many professors, I love teaching, but even if I hated it, 150 hours a year is a light burden. The rest of the time I think, read, and write about whatever interests me. That's called research. My salary doesn't make me wealthy, but I wouldn't trade places with Bill Gates. His billions can't buy me anything I crave I don't already have. And I bet that even in retirement, Gates lacks my peace of mind. Personally, then, I have no reason to lash out at the education system. Quite the contrary. Yet a lifetime of experience plus a quarter century of reading and reflection convince me that our education system is a big waste of time and money. Almost every politician vows to spend more on education. As an insider, I can't help gasping, why? You want us to waste even more? Most critics of our education system complain we aren't spending our money in the right way, or that preachers in teachers' clothing are leading our nation's children down dark paths. While I semi-sympathize, these critics miss what I see as our educational system's supreme defect. There's way too much education. Typical students burn thousands of hours studying material that neither raises their productivity nor enriches their lives. And of course, students can't waste time without experts to show them how. Schools obviously teach some broadly useful skills, especially literacy and numeracy. High schools often include a few vocational electives, auto shop, computer programming, woodworking. Most colleges offer some career-oriented majors, engineering, computer science, pre-med. But what about all the other courses, all the other majors? Think about all the classes you ever took. How many failed to teach you any useful skills? The lessons you'll never need to know after graduation start in kindergarten. Elementary schools teach more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. They also require history, social studies, music, art, and physical education. Middle and high schools add higher mathematics, classic literature, and foreign languages. Vital for a handful of budding scientists, authors, and translators, irrelevant for everyone else. Most college majors don't even pretend to teach job skills. If you apply your knowledge of Roman history, Shakespeare, real analysis, or philosophy of mind on the job, you have an odd job. You might defend this allegedly useless education on humanistic grounds. Teachers habitually claim to enrich students' lives or broaden their horizons. As a professor, I don't just sympathize with these arguments. I've lived them. The great ideas have enriched me, and I try to pay it forward. To effectively defend education, however, you need to do more than appeal to humanistic ideals. You need to ask, how often do academics successfully broaden students' horizons? Empirically, the answer is bleak, While great teachers can turn students into Shakespeare fans, Civil War buffs, avant-garde artists, and devoted violinists, such transformations are rare. Despite teachers' best efforts, most youths find high culture boring, and few change their minds in adulthood. Learning doesn't have to be useful. Learning doesn't have to be inspirational. When learning is neither useful nor inspirational, though, how can we call it anything but wasteful? Signaling. Why the market pays you to kill time. Posing this question to our sacred educational system sparks a chorus of objections. The most vexing objections, however, are my fellow economists. How can anyone call education wasteful in an age when its financial payoff has hit a record high? The earnings premium for college grads has rocketed to over 70%. Even high school graduation pays a hefty 30% premium relative to dropping out. If education really fails to raise worker productivity, why do employers bid so lavishly for educated labor? Later, I will explain why these premiums are gross overestimates. For now, though, let the numbers stand. How could such a lucrative investment be wasteful? The answer is a single word I seek to burn into your mind. Signaling. Even if what a student learned in school is utterly useless, employers will happily pay extra if their scholastic achievement provides information about their productivity. Suppose your law firm wants a summer associate. A law student with a PhD in philosophy from Stanford applies. What do you infer? The applicant is probably brilliant, diligent, and willing to tolerate serious boredom. If you're looking for that kind of worker, and what employer isn't, you'll make a generous offer. You could readily do so, knowing full well that nothing the philosopher learned at Stanford applies on the job. We're quick to draw inferences from educational history, and with good reason. Your educational record reveals much about your ability and character. When you hear someone finished a BA at MIT in 3 years, you think, genius. When you hear someone has been one class short of a bachelor's degree for the last decade, you think, slacker. When you hear someone flunked out of high school, you think, not too bright. When you hear someone flunked out of high school then immediately aced the GED, you think, pretty bright but really lazy, or pretty bright but deeply troubled. Lesson. Even if a degree did raise your pay by 70%, that would hardly prove your education made you what you are today. Perhaps you already were what you are today the first time you entered the classroom. Look at your transcript and check it against what you've actually done with your life. You could have missed a ton of coursework with no loss of on-the-job competence. Unfortunately, if you tried to skip school and leap straight to your first job, insisting, "I have the right stuff to graduate, I just choose not to," employers wouldn't believe you. Anyone can say, "I have the right stuff to graduate, I just choose not to." And firms don't give a 70% wage premium to just anyone. Lest I be misinterpreted, I emphatically affirm that some education teaches useful skills, or as economists put it, builds human capital. People learn literacy and numeracy in school. Most modern jobs require these skills. I learned statistics in graduate school. I use statistics in my job. When this audiobook criticizes human capital stories, it does not reject the view that schools build some human capital. It rejects human capital purism, the view that A, virtually all education teaches useful job skills, and B, these job skills are virtually the sole reason why education pays off in the labor market. When this audiobook defends the signaling theory of education similarly, it does not claim all education is signaling. It claims a significant fraction of education is signaling. What precisely does significant fraction mean? First, at least one-third of students' time in school is signaling. Second, at least one-third of the financial reward students enjoy is signaling. Personally, I think the true fraction exceeds 50%, probably more like 80%. My rhetoric reflects this judgment. As the case against education unfolds, however, we shall see that even if the share of signaling in our education system is as low as one-third, our education system wastes a mountain of time and money. And when you reflect on your first-hand experience with school and work, one-third signaling is the lowest share you can plausibly maintain. To be fair, people rarely self-identify as human capital purists. Human capital purism is a default position, a path of least resistance. We see human capital purism whenever politicians or pundits call education funding investment in people, without hinting that education might be anything else. We see human capital purism whenever social scientists measure the effect of education on earnings, then call it the effect of education on skill. We see human capital purism whenever teachers or parents end an educational sermon with, "Schools teach kids what they need to know when they grow up." At this point, one could object, though education teaches few practical skills, that hardly makes it wasteful. By your own admission, education serves a vital function, certifying the quality of labor. That's useful, isn't it? Indeed. However, this is a dangerous admission for the champion of education. If education merely certifies labor quality, society would be better off if we all got less. Think about it like this. A college degree now puts you in the top third of the education distribution, so employers who seek a top third worker require this credential. Now imagine everyone with one fewer degree. In this world, employers in need of a top-third worker would require only a high school diploma. The quality of labor would be certified about as accurately as now, at a cost savings of 4 years of school per person. Education, private profit, social waste. Does this audiobook advise you to cut your education short because you won't learn much of value anyway? Absolutely not. In the signaling model, studying irrelevancies still raises income by impressing employers. To unilaterally curtail your education is to voluntarily leap into a lower quality pool of workers. The labor market brands you accordingly. For a single individual, education pays. On this point, the standard education as skill creation and the education as signaling theories agree. The theories make different predictions, however, about what happens if average education levels decline. If education is all skill creation, a fall in average education saps our skills, impoverishing the world. If education is all signaling, however, a fall in average education leaves our skills and the wealth of the world unchanged. In fact, cutbacks enrich the world by conserving valuable time and resources. Suppose you agree society would benefit if average education declined. Is this achievable? Verily. Government heavily subsidizes education. In 2011, U.S. federal, state, and local governments spent almost $1 trillion on it. The simplest way to get less education, then, is to cut the subsidies. This would not eliminate wasteful signaling, but at least government would pour less gasoline on the fire. The thought of education cuts horrifies most people because we all benefit from education. I maintain their horror rests on what logicians call a fallacy of composition, the belief that what is true for a part must also be true for the whole. The classic example? You want a better view at a concert. What can you do? Stand up. Individually, standing works. What happens, though, if everyone copies you? Can everyone see better by standing? No way. Popular support for education subsidies rests on the same fallacy. The person who gets more education gets a better job. It works. You see it plainly. Yet it does not follow that if everyone gets more education, everyone gets a better job. In the signaling model, subsidizing everyone's schooling to improve our jobs is like urging everyone to stand up at a concert to improve our views. Both are smart for one, dumb for all. To be maximally blunt, we would be better off if education were less affordable. If subsidies for education were drastically reduced, many could no longer afford the education they now plan to get. If I am correct, however, this is no cause for alarm. It is precisely because education is so affordable that the labor market expects us to possess so much. Without the subsidies, you would no longer need the education you can no longer afford. Ultimately, I believe the best education policy is no education policy at all, the separation of school and state. However, you can buy the substance of my argument without embracing my crazy extremism. You can grant the importance of signaling in education and still favor substantial government assistance for the industry. If you conclude education is only one-third signaling, your preferred level of government assistance will noticeably fall, but not to zero. At the same time, I do not downplay potentially radical implications. If, like me, you deem education 80% signaling, ending taxpayer support is crazy like a fox. This is especially clear if, as I ultimately argue, the humanistic benefits of education are mostly wishful thinking. Anyone listening to this audiobook has almost certainly spent over a decade in school. You have vast first-hand knowledge of the education industry. The unfolding argument takes full advantage of your decade plus of personal experience. Please test all claims about the true nature of education against your own abundant educational experience. This does not mean my contrarian thesis is obvious. Far from it. Yet for the most part, the audiobook does not try to change your mind about brute facts. It tries to change your mind about the best way to interpret facts you've known for ages. Once you calmly review your experience through my lens, I bet you'll admit I've got a point. Education is a strange industry, but familiarity masks the strangeness. I want to revive your sense of wonder. Consider the typical high school curriculum. English is the international language of business, but American high school students spend years studying Spanish, or even French. Few jobs require knowledge of higher mathematics, but over 80% of high school grads suffer through geometry. Students study history for years, but history teachers are almost the only people alive who use history on the job. Required coursework is so ill-suited to students' needs, you have to wonder if your eyes are playing tricks on you. In part, we accept this strange curriculum as normal because we're used to it. On a deeper level, though, we accept our education system because it works. If you get more school and better grades, employers reward you. What more must you know? If you're only looking out for number one, nothing. Go to school, get good grades, make more money. The recipe is sound. But if you want to know whether your education system is a good deal for society, or if you're a curious person, the strange stuff students study is a vital clue. So is the fact that employers pay students extra for studying strange stuff. Faced with these clues, the orthodox view that students go to school to acquire job skills only shrugs. The signaling model of education uses these clues to detect and solve a great neglected social mystery. Chapter 1. The Magic of Education. Don't tell fish stories where the people know you, but particularly don't tell them where they know the fish. Mark Twain. For an economics professor, I have broad interests. Economics aside, I read widely in philosophy, political science, history, psychology, and education. But what do I really know how to do? In all honesty, not much. In junior high and high school, I worked a few hours a week manually collating sections of the Los Angeles Times. In 1990, I had a summer data entry job with a home builder. I haven't had a real job since. People pay me to lecture, write, and think my thoughts. These are virtually my only marketable skills. I'm hardly unique. The stereotype of the head-in-the-clouds ivory tower academic is funny because it's true. The ivory tower routinely ignores the real world. Strangely, though, the disinterest is not mutual. Employers care deeply about professors' opinions. Not, of course, our opinions about epistemology or immigration, but employers throughout the economy defer to teachers' opinions when they decide whom to interview, whom to hire, and how much to pay them. Students with straight A's from top schools write their own tickets. A single F in a required course prevents graduation, closing the door to most well-paid jobs. Every now and then, foolhardy critics of the education industry flatly deny the financial benefits. Since all statistics are against them, they turn to anecdotes. I know a girl who finished her BA 4 years ago but still works at Starbucks. My son has a PhD in philosophy, and he drives a cab. I can't get a job with my MFA in puppetry. While such things do happen, the world is vast. The key question is whether anecdotes about failed investments in education are the exception or the rule. Statistics give a clear answer. As a rule, education pays. High school graduates earn more than dropouts, college grads earn more than high school grads, and holders of advanced degrees do better still. Enduring another year of school will, on average, get you a raise for the rest of your career. What kind of raise? A standard figure is about 10%. Better educated workers also enjoy higher non-cash benefits, better quality of life, and lower unemployment. Apparent rewards shrink after various statistical corrections. We'll see how later on. Still, no matter what corrections you make, schooling pays in the labor market. Otherworldly education. Most actual job skills are acquired informally through on-the-job training after a worker finds an entry job and a position on the associated promotional ladder. Lester Thoreau, Education and Economic Equality. The key question isn't whether employers care a lot about grades and diplomas, but why. The simple, popular answer is that schools teach their students useful job skills. Low grades, no diploma, few skills. This simple, popular answer is not utterly wrong. Literacy and numeracy are crucial in most occupations. Yet the education as skills story, better known to social scientists as human capital theory, dodges puzzling questions. First and foremost, from kindergarten on, students spend thousands of hours studying subjects irrelevant to the modern labor market. How can this be? Why do English classes focus on literature and poetry instead of business and technical writing? Why do advanced math classes bother with proofs almost no student can follow? When will the typical student use history, trigonometry, art, music, physics, physical education, Spanish, French, Latin? High schools still teach it, believe it or not. The class clown who snarks, "What does this have to do with real life?" is onto something. The disconnect between curriculum and job market has a banal explanation. Educators teach what they know, and most have as little first-hand knowledge of the modern workplace as I do. Yet this merely amplifies the puzzle. If schools boost students' income by teaching useful job skills, why do they entrust students' education to people so detached from the real world? How are educators supposed to foster our students' ability to do the countless jobs we can't do ourselves? Anyone who thinks I exaggerate the gap between the skills students learn and the skills workers use can look at the current graduation requirements for my alma mater, Granada Hills High School, now Granada Hills Charter High School. Students need 4 years of English, 2 years of algebra, 2 years of the same foreign language, 2 years of physical education, and a year in each of the following: geometry, biology, physical science, world history, American history, economics, government, and a visual or performing art. Students also have to complete 10 to 14 elective classes. If you fail more than two classes, you do not graduate. Passing all this coursework serves one practical function: college entry. Granada's high school graduation requirements almost perfectly match admission requirements for the University of California and California State University systems. But what additional practical function do these requirements serve? For college-bound students, the honest answer is not much. Few college graduates use higher mathematics, foreign languages, history, or the arts on the job. For students who aren't college-bound, the honest answer is virtually none. If you don't go to college, your job almost certainly won't require knowledge of geometry, French, world history, or drama. Graduation requirements for the University of California, Berkeley, where I earned my bachelor's degree, are similarly otherworldly. Suppose you're in the College of Letters and Science. To graduate, you need a total of 120 credits, roughly four courses a semester for 4 years. You have to pass your breadth requirements. One course in each of the following: arts and literature, biological science, historical studies, international studies, philosophy and values, physical science, and social and behavioral sciences. You also have to complete your major requirements. Suppose you major in economics, widely seen as a practical, realistic subject. Graduates need introductory economics, statistics, intermediate microeconomics, intermediate macroeconomics, econometrics, 5 upper division courses, and a year of calculus. While this coursework is decent preparation for econ graduate school, students are likely to use only 2, statistics and econometrics, in a non-academic job. Even that shouldn't be overstated. Statistics and econometrics courses at elite colleges emphasize mathematical proofs, not hands-on statistical training. Permanent residents of the Ivory Tower often congratulate themselves for broadening students' horizons. For the most part, however, broaden means expose students to yet another subject they'll never use in real life. Put yourself in the shoes of a Martian sociologist. Your mission: given our curriculum, make an educated guess about what our economy looks like. The Martian would plausibly work backward from the premise that the curriculum prepares students to be productive adults. Since students study reading, writing, and math, you would correctly infer that the modern economy requires literacy and numeracy. So far, so good. From then on, however, the Martian would leap from one erroneous inference to another. Students spend years studying foreign languages, so there must be lots of translators. Teachers emphasize classic literature and poetry. A thriving market in literary criticism is the logical explanation. Every student has to take algebra and geometry. The Martian sociologist will conclude the typical worker occasionally solves quadratic equations and checks triangles for congruence. While we can picture an economy that fits our curriculum like a glove, that economy is out of this world. If education boosts income by improving students' skills, we shouldn't be puzzled merely by the impractical subjects students have to study. We should be equally puzzled by the eminently practical subjects they don't have to study. Why don't educators familiarize students with compensation and job satisfaction in common occupations? Strategies for breaking into various industries, sectors with rapidly changing employment. Why don't schools make students spend a full year learning how to write a resume or affect a can-do attitude? Dire sins of omission. The puzzle isn't merely the weak tie between curriculum and labor market. The puzzle is the weak tie between curriculum and labor market combined with the strong tie between educational success and professional success. The way our education system transforms students into paid workers seems like magic. Governments delegate vast power to a caste of ivory tower academics. The caste wields its power as expected. Every child has to study teachers' pet subjects. Educators then rank students on their mastery of the material. Students rapidly forget most of what they learn because they'll never need to know it again. Employers are free to discount or disregard the ivory tower's verdicts. Yet they use academic track records to decide whom to hire and how much to pay. The process seems even more magical when you're one of the wizards. I go to class and talk to students about my exotic interests, everything from the market for marriage to the economics of the mafia to the self-interested voter hypothesis. At the end of the semester, I test their knowledge. As far as I can tell, the only marketable skill I teach is how to be an economics professor. Yet employers seemingly disagree. Anyone who's not dumbstruck should be. Do students need to understand the market for marriage, the economics of the mafia, or the self-interested voter hypothesis to be a competent manager, banker, or salesman? No. But because I decide these topics are worth teaching, employers decide students who fail my class aren't worth interviewing. Abracadabra. Unlike many magic tricks, this is not a case of the hand is quicker than the eye. The mystery doesn't go away when you review the process in slow motion. Step 1. I talk about topics I find thought-provoking. Step 2. Students learn something about the topics I cover. Step 3. Magic? Step 4. My students' prospects in management, banking, sales, etc. slightly improve. When I train PhD students to become economics professors, there's no magic. They want to do my job. I show them how it's done. But the vast majority of my students won't be professors of economics. They won't be professors of anything. How then do my classes make my students more employable? I can't teach what I don't know, and I don't know how to do the jobs most of my students are going to have. Few professors do. Making magic pay. Magic isn't real. There has to be a logical explanation for the effect of ivory tower achievement on real-world success, and here it is. Despite the chasm between what students learn and what workers do, academic success is a strong signal of worker productivity. The labor market doesn't pay you for the useless subjects you master. It pays you for the pre-existing traits you reveal by mastering them. Certifying pre-existing skills is so easy that despite my lifelong sequestration in the ivory tower, I know how to do it. How? By acting like a typical professor. I lecture about my nerdy obsessions. I make my students do some homework and take some tests. When the semester ends, I grade them based on their mastery of the material. Absent a miracle, my students will never apply the economics of the mafia on the job, no matter. As long as the right stuff to succeed in my class overlaps with the right stuff to succeed on the job, employers are wise to prefer my A students to my F students. I naturally have to share influence with my fellow educators. I can tip my students' grade point average by only a decimal point. Still, mild influence adds up. I've taught thousands of students over the years, and my condemnation is devastating. A single F can derail graduation and prompt employers to trash your resume. Students who value worldly success, therefore, strive to impress educators with their brilliance and industry, or at least avoid appalling us with their stupidity and sloth. Practical relevance makes little difference. You won't use Shakespeare on the job, but without the right credentials, the job you crave will forever elude you. Basics of signaling. Signaling is no fringe idea. Mike Spence, Kenneth Arrow, Joseph Stiglitz, Thomas Schelling, and Edmund Phelps, all Nobel laureates in economics, made seminal contributions. The Nobel Committee hailed Michael Spence's work on signaling as his prize-winning discovery, and added, "An important example is education as a signal of high individual productivity in the labor market. It is not necessary for education to have intrinsic value. Costly investment in education as such signals high ability." Signaling models have three basic elements. First, there must be different types of people. Types could differ in intelligence, conscientiousness, conformity, whatever. Second, an individual's type must be non-obvious. You can't discover a person's true work ethic with a glance. You certainly can't ask, "How good is your work ethic?" and expect candor. Third, types must visibly differ on average. In technical terms, send a different signal. Deviations from average are okay. A signal doesn't have to be definitive, just better than nothing. Given these three basic elements, employers' honest answer to who's truly the best worker for the job will always be, "I'm stumped." The question's unanswerable with available information. Fortunately, employers can bypass their ignorance by answering an easier question. Which worker sends the best signals? There's no cheap way to directly measure conformity. But perhaps people with crew cuts are, on average, more conformist than people with mohawks. If so, prudent employers treat hairstyle as a signal of conformity. As long as short-haired rebels and compliant hippies are exceptions that prove the rule, hiring by hair beats hiring by coin flip. Once employers reward mere signals of productivity, would-be workers have a clear incentive to modify the signal they send, to tailor their behavior to make a good impression. To what end? Getting favorable treatment. If suspected conformists make more money, and conformists are more likely to have crew cuts pay. They pay even if you're a rebel at heart. the rebellious worker with a crew cut impersonates a conformist. You might jump to the conclusion that signaling sows the seeds of its own destruction. If a crew cut creates a favorable impression and elicits favorable treatment, why wouldn't every worker head straight to the barber? The signaling model contains a simple answer. Viable signals must be less costly for types in higher demand. This cost could be measured in money or time, or it could be purely emotional. If rebels detest square haircuts and conformists don't, hairstyle is an excellent signal of conformity. Once every worker has a crew cut, you can top up your conformity signal with a gray flannel suit. The rat race stabilizes when impersonating a conformist is, on average, such a chore that rebels stop pretending to be something they're not. The on-average qualifier is crucial. Suppose 10% of good workers can't afford a suit. If employers can't figure out why you're underdressed for your interview, a good worker who doesn't have a suit to wear will be treated the same as a bad worker who can't bear to wear one. As the fraction of good workers who can't afford a suit rises, however, the less your attire shows about you, and the less employers care about what you wear. Clear signals carry a strong stigma. Fuzzy signals, a weak stigma. Critics often paint the signaling model of education as weird or implausible, but the model is just a special case of what economists call statistical discrimination, using true-on-average stereotypes to save time and money. Statistical discrimination is everywhere. The elderly pay higher life insurance premiums because the elderly tend to die sooner. Cab drivers are more willing to pick up a young man in a suit than a young man in gang colors because the latter is more likely to rob him. Statistical discrimination may be unfair and ugly, but it's hardly weird or implausible. Why is it any more weird or implausible to claim employers statistically discriminate on the basis of educational credentials? What does education signal? From the standpoint of most teachers, right up to and including the level of teachers of college undergraduates, the ideal student is well-behaved, unaggressive, docile, patient, meticulous, and empathetic in the sense of intuiting the response to the teacher that is most likely to please the teacher. Richard Posner, The New Gender Gap in Education. Like many great ideas, signaling is obvious once you think about it. Yet almost no economist denies that Spence, Arrow, Stiglitz, Schelling, and Phelps were brilliant pioneers. They made signaling obvious. Still, for all the homage they pay these Nobelists, economists have kept the model in a ghetto. Theorists play with the idea at the highest level, but when empiricists study the real world, signaling is lucky to get a footnote. This audiobook's goal is to emancipate the signaling model from its ghetto, then use the theory to explain the mismatched marriage between school and work. When you're hunting for a job, you send an array of signals, haircut, clothes, punctuality, polite laughter at interviewers' jokes. Yet in modern labor markets, one signal overshadows the rest, your education. Many employers won't deign to read your application unless you possess the right educational credentials. Even when it's common knowledge, your book learning won't come up on the job. Why is educational signaling so central? An initially tempting answer: good jobs are intellectually demanding, and education is just a signal of intelligence. This intelligence alone story looks solid on the surface. Our information age has unleashed the revenge of the nerds. Education really is a strong signal of intelligence, and reality TV stars notwithstanding, today's lucrative occupations reliably require high cognitive ability. If you put pressure on the intelligence alone story, however, it cracks. Consider this vignette. Mark and Steve both got perfect scores on their SATs when they were 16 years old. 20 years later, Mark has a PhD from MIT, but Steve has only a high school degree. If the only thing you knew about Mark and Steve were their educational credentials, you would jump to the conclusion that Mark is a lot smarter. Given their SAT scores, though, you almost automatically shift to the view that Mark is a harder worker. Indeed, once you know Steve's test scores, you swiftly infer he's pathologically lazy, or perhaps a free spirit. In an interview, Steve would pose as a diligent worker bee. He'd make excuses or change the subject to his strengths. But given his educational history, the typical employer would be nervous. What then does education signal besides intelligence? As Socrates would say, you already know the answer. Mark and Steve's vignette shows that education signals not just intelligence, but conscientiousness, the student's discipline, work ethic, commitment to quality, and so forth. Is that everything? No, we're still overlooking a crucial trait. Consider another vignette. Jen and Karen scored higher on their SATs than 3 out of 4 students. After high school graduation, both took full-time jobs. However, they spent their evenings differently. Jen spent 20 hours a week earning her college degree part-time. Karen, in contrast, spent 20 hours a week creating the world's biggest ball of yarn. 5 years after high school graduation, Jen has her degree and Karen her record-breaking ball of yarn. Jen and Karen don't just seem equally smart, they seem equally conscientious. Both had the stick-to-itiveness to complete a challenging project in their spare time. Yet Jen sounds more employable because she toiled in the service of socially approved goals. Karen, in contrast, pursued her eccentric vanity project. Jen's degree signals her deference to social expectations. She's a team player. When the boss says jump, she'll ask, how high? Karen's ball of yarn sends a mixed signal at best. She works hard when she puts her mind to something. But will she work hard to please her boss? The vignette's lesson? Education also signals conformity, the worker's grasp of and submission to social expectations. Actually, that's an understatement. In our society, educational achievement is a social expectation. Model workers are supposed to pursue and obtain traditional credentials, a high school diploma for virtually any job, a bachelor's degree for a good job. If you violate these expectations, you're moderately nonconformist. If you defy these expectations, you're extremely nonconformist. When you lack credentials, the best backup signal of conformity isn't to denounce credentialism, but to humbly hold your tongue. To be clear, employers aren't looking for workers who conform in some abstract sense. As anthropologists emphasize, almost everyone conforms to something. Hippies strive to look, talk, and act like fellow hippies. This doesn't make unkempt hair and tie-dye shirts any less repugnant to employers. Employers are looking for people who conform to the folk ways of today's workplace. People who look, talk, and act like modern model workers. What are modern model workers like? They're team players. They're deferential to superiors, but not slavish. They're congenial toward co-workers, but put business first. They dress and groom conservatively. They say nothing remotely racist or sexist, and they stay a mile away from anything construable as sexual harassment. Perhaps most importantly, they know and do what's expected, even when articulating social norms is difficult or embarrassing. Employers don't have to tell a modern model worker what's socially acceptable case by case. Now we're up to 3 broad traits that education signals: intelligence, conscientiousness, and conformity. We could easily extend this list. Education also signals a prosperous family, cosmopolitan attitudes, and fondness for foreign films. For a profit-maximizing employer, however, the extensions are a distraction. The road to academic success is paved with the trinity of intelligence, conscientiousness, and conformity. The stronger your academic record, the greater employer's confidence you have the whole package. Why do employers seek this package? Because the road to academic success and the road to job success are paved with the same materials. An intelligent worker learns quickly and deeply. A conscientious worker labors until the job's done right. A conformist worker obeys superiors and cooperates with teammates. If you lack the right stuff to succeed in school, you probably lack the right stuff to succeed in the labor market. Exceptions exist, of course. Fantastic workers might have weak educational credentials because their family is poor. They might have weak educational credentials because they're averse to student debt. They might have weak educational credentials because they couldn't wait to start doing things in the real world, or fail to grasp the signaling model. As long as the exceptions remain exceptions, signaling works. Employers are running businesses, not logic classes. Hiring decisions, like all business decisions, are about prudence, not proof. Locked-in syndrome. Education is clearly one good way to show employers you've got the right stuff to succeed on the job. For many jobs, however, education is practically the only route to success. Peculiar. After all, there are endless signals of intelligence, conscientiousness, and conformity. You could signal intelligence by blogging about science fiction. You could signal conscientiousness by copying the dictionary by hand. You could signal conformity by keeping kosher, even though you aren't Jewish. When you seek a job, however, such signals are worthless. Why do employers find educational credentials so much more enticing? Education signals a package of socially desirable strengths. People at the top of their class usually have the trifecta: intelligent, conscientious, and conformist. Humbler students send a weaker but still lucrative signal. They're sufficiently intelligent, conscientious, and conformist to earn a degree. This doesn't mean they're above average in all three. As long as you manage to graduate, though, you're probably strong in at least one and woefully deficient in none. Heterodox signals of your strength, in contrast, automatically suggest offsetting weaknesses. Suppose you scored well on the SAT but never went to college. Employers will readily believe you're smart, but if you're so smart, why didn't you go to college? As long as your conscientiousness and conformity were in the normal range, finishing college would have been a snap. Once employers see your SATs, they naturally infer you're below average in conscientiousness and conformity. The higher your scores, the more suspicious your missing diploma becomes. This is even clearer if you try to signal your braininess by, say, blogging about science fiction. If you have the brains to master Isaac Asimov, you should also excel in school, unless, of course, your issues keep getting in the way. The logic of offsetting weakness holds for signals of conscientiousness, too. If you have the work ethic to copy the dictionary by hand, completing college should be a cakewalk, unless you're slow-witted or play poorly with others. So when you offer odd displays of conscientiousness instead of conventional diplomas, employers are doubly suspicious. If you're such a workhorse, why strive to bypass 4 years of academic drudgery? Maybe you're so deficient in smarts and social skills that your undivided effort isn't enough to get through college. Unconventional signals of conformity suffer from a deeper flaw, an outright catch-22. Alternative signals of conformity signal non-conformity. Once a conventional bachelor's degree is the standard signal of conformity, outside-the-box substitutes are suspicious at best. Telling employers, "I'm self-taught," or "I graduated from a brand new internet university," makes you sound weird. The further outside the box your substitute signal of conformity, the more it backfires. Try telling employers, "I'm not Jewish, but I keep kosher to prove I can conform to intricate rules." They'll take you for a freak. It's no surprise, then, that graduation years are much more lucrative than ordinary years. Students are supposed to graduate. If they don't, employers fear they're deeply defective. The catch-22 of conformity signaling is so binding that people occasionally withhold good signals to avoid looking socially unaware. Consider norms against bragging. You aren't supposed to trumpet your strengths, even if you can prove every word you say. Braggarts, therefore, send mixed signals at best. Even if they're as smart and accomplished as they say, they're boors. A striking illustration from the job market. While employers rarely request applicants' standardized test scores, applicants remain free to provide these scores on their resumes. Few do. What do applicants have to lose? The word on the street? Putting high scores on your resume suggests you're smart but socially inept. You're doing something that's simply not done. As I once heard a professor berate a graduate student, "Putting your GRE scores on your resume makes you look like a student. Departments want to hire promising assistant professors, not brilliant pupils." What's most special about education, though, is that almost everyone in our society believes education is special. In modern America, kids with the right stuff to succeed in real life ask, how can I excel in school? Not, isn't there some other signal I could send instead? The connection between educational success and career success is naturally strong because both challenges call for similar strengths. Social norms take this naturally strong connection and make it unnaturally strong. The process is self-reinforcing. Step one, employers notice the link between success at school and success at work, so they use education as a gatekeeper of the labor market. If good, uncredentialed workers are sufficiently rare, employers ignore their very existence. Step two, talented, motivated people notice education's gatekeeping role, so they devote themselves to educational success in order to fulfill their career ambitions. Step three, the frequency of talented, motivated people without a strong academic record falls, tightening the link between success at school and success at work. Step four, return to step one. Plenty of alternatives to traditional education already exist, but unaccompanied by standard credentials, these alternatives send employers the wrong message. The problem, the people most eager to abandon traditional education in favor of alternatives tend to be subpar workers. Employers judge you by the company you keep. If you have the right stuff to earn traditional credentials, you face a stark choice. Do what's socially expected, or take your chances with the outcasts. This father-daughter talk from 2009's An Education is a telling dramatization. Jenny, can I stop going to the youth orchestra then? Dad, no. The youth orchestra is a good thing. That shows you're a joiner inner. Jenny, yes, but I've already joined in. So now I can stop. Dad, no. Well, that just shows the opposite, don't you see? No, that shows you're a rebel. They don't want that at Oxford. Jenny, no. They don't want people who think for themselves. Dad, no. Of course they don't. In short, education suffers from what I call locked-in syndrome. If you want the labor market to recognize your strengths, and most of the people who share your strengths hold a credential, you'd better earn one, too. Otherwise, employers won't take you seriously enough to give you a chance. Eventually, we end up where we are, an economy where hard-headed employers say, education über alles, circular relevance notwithstanding. Signaling simply doesn't make sense. The leading objections to the signaling model of education are not that it contradicts experience. Virtually everyone has spent years experiencing the irrelevant education the labor market demands. Rather, the leading objections insist experience is deceiving. Paying workers to study useless subjects year after year just doesn't make sense. Appearances notwithstanding, the signaling model can't be right. All such complaints suffer a shared flaw. Critics assume a simplistic version of signaling, then beat it to a pulp. In the end, happily, their complaints are constructive. Simplistic objections to signaling help us craft a subtle, true-to-life version of the model. Signaling equals 100% signaling. The most egregious straw man treats signaling as all or nothing. Critics then refute signaling by pointing out that schools teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. What a devastating objection to a version of the signaling model no one holds. Nobel Prize winner Kenneth Arrow anticipated and disavowed 100% signaling way back in 1973. Perhaps I should make clear that I personally do not believe that higher education performs only a screening purpose. Clearly, professional schools impart real skills valued in the market, and so do undergraduate courses in the sciences. The case is considerably less clear with regard to the bulk of liberal arts courses. To the best of my knowledge, no proponent of the signaling model ever challenged Arrow on this point. The curriculum clearly contains useful subjects. The labor market predictably rewards you for learning them. The point of the signaling model of education isn't to deny the obvious, but to explain the mysterious. How come so many subjects in the curriculum don't seem useful? And why does the labor market nevertheless reward you for learning them? Signaling equals signaling intelligence alone. Other critics equate signaling with the view that education signals nothing but intelligence. Then they demolish it. Sure, a diploma signals intelligence, but so does an IQ test. Why should employers insist on a 4-year degree if a 3-hour exam is equally revealing? Firms that refused to test would pointlessly cull qualified applicants. The right lesson to draw is not that the signaling model is wrong, but that education signals more than intelligence. Most of the model's friends learned this lesson long ago. Kenneth Arrow, as usual, knew it from the start. Higher education as a filter calls education a signal of ability and explicitly states that ability depends on socialization as well as intelligence. Or, as Peter Wiles succinctly said 1 year later, what employers need is intelligent conformism or great independence and originality within a narrow range. Signaling shouldn't take years. Another top anti-signaling talking point, education drags on for years, which doesn't make sense. Why can't hard-working team players signal their worthiness with, say, 1 year in school, then instantly get a good job in the real world? If education were largely signaling, employers would have discovered a cheaper, quicker way to evaluate worker quality ages ago. The critics again take a simplistic version of the model for granted. They picture a signal as definitive proof of a worker's quality. Once you send the signal, the truth shines forth for all to see. For many traits, however, there are no definitive show-stopping signs. You can always enhance employers' confidence. When the competition sends better signals and you don't, employers, unsurprisingly, think less of you. Consider this vignette. Fred and Dana seem equally smart in their interviews. Both insist they're hard-working team players. But Fred dropped out of college after his first year. Dana, in contrast, has her degree in hand. The labor market will clearly favor Dana. Employers may get a good read on Fred and Dana's intelligence during their interviews. Their conscientiousness and conformity, however, are fakeable. An employer can't ask Fred, "Are you a hard-working team player?" and hire him when he says yes. An employer can't just watch Fred work for a few hours. With a job at stake, even a slacker will work like a dog. The same holds when Fred finishes 1 year of college. A lazy rebel will toil and conform for 2 semesters if the wage is right. To signal you're the real deal, a hard-working team player must outlast the posers and wannabes. As my colleague Tyler Cowan, ordinarily a signaling skeptic, once admitted, it does not suffice to give everyone a test and hire people with the highest scores. Doing well on a test is no guarantee of perseverance. The signal must be costly and grueling, otherwise it fails to sort out the best job candidates. Contrary to critics, then, the sheer duration of education doesn't refute signaling. Since easy-to-fake traits like conscientiousness and conformity are valuable, education has to take years. Signaling is a war of attrition. Giving up early is surrender. The longer you endure, the stronger you look. The victors, the people who get the best jobs, are the last students standing. You can't fool the market for long. Is signaling superfluous? Some critics maintain employers discern their employees' true productivity in a matter of months. After this brief trial period, the market no longer pays big bucks for mere credentials. Nobel laureate Gary Becker speculates that the signaling model declined because economists began to realize that companies rather quickly discover the productivity of employees who went to college, whether a Harvard or a University of Phoenix. Before long, their pay corrects to their productivity rather than to their education credentials. When researchers explicitly gauge the speed of employer learning, the process seems to take years or decades, not months, especially for the sizable majority that don't finish college. We'll explore this evidence later on. For now, suppose Becker is right. In 3 months, employers see beyond credentials to reality. This hardly makes signaling futile. Instead, it suggests the main reason to signal is to get your foot in the door, to secure your first job. By definition, this happens only once in a lifetime, yet it is no small affair. Unless your foot is in the door, your talent and character go to waste. You can't fool the market for long doesn't imply the market won't overlook you forever. Becker hails employers' ability to spot phonies, to discover workers whose diplomas overstate their performance. Even if he's right, he overlooks the flip side of the problem, employers' ability to spot diamonds in the rough, to discover workers whose diplomas understate their performance. To do so is exorbitantly costly. Employers can't afford to give every applicant an interview, much less a job. What's a diamond in the rough to do? Get the credentials you need for your big break. 3 months later, when your new boss finally sees the real you, your credentials don't suddenly become a mistake. Without those credentials, your career would never have gotten